You are listening to SPN, the Sports Podcasting Network. And you are listening to SPN, the Sports Podcasting Network.
Welcome back to the Five Rings Podcast. Dwayne Rollins with Kevin Laramie. Joining us on the line is Meg Linehan. She is soon to be the managing editor of Excel Sports. Meg is also an expert on women's hockey and women's soccer, for that matter. A good follow on Twitter. We'll get her Twitter address out at the end. Meg, how are you doing?
I'm pretty good today. How are you?
I'm well. We wanted to have you on to talk about the NWHL and what is currently happening within that. It just completed its first season, but rather than talk about, you know, the wonderful athletes on the ice, instead, we're talking about battles in court. Can you just lay the land for us and tell us what's happening right now?
Sure. So right at the moment, there's actually no official lawsuit on the books yet. They were expecting it yesterday. It doesn't look like it got filed in time. So sounds like it might happen today. But basically what's happening is there's a founding investor, Mike Moran, who seems to have been involved since the founding days of the league, definitely had some sort of at least friendly relationship with the league's commissioner, Danny Ryland, and he's now looking for either his founding investment, personal loans. There's a little bit of unknown here as to what the official investment relationship is, but he invested about $200,000 into the league, has been trying, it sounds like, for many months to get that investment back. And so what's been happening over the last few days is there was a letter of demand from his legal representation to the league asking for an amount right around $184,000. Said that the league had offered him $100,000, was not acceptable on his terms, looking for $184,000. The deadline was this past Friday at 5 p.m. Eastern time. That deadline appears to have come and gone. So now we're waiting to see if the lawsuit is actually filed. It seems like an amount probably over $200,000. Excel Sports, we were able to obtain redacted documents that have like direct evidence of investments, checks, Bank of America statements, that sort of thing. When I totaled those up, it was about $193,000, give or take, but I'm not sure all of those will be in the scope of that lawsuit.
All right, Meg, this sounds like if this were to be a successful action, and we don't know whether it would be or not, but if it were, that this would actually put this league in jeopardy. Is that a fair assumption?
It definitely sounds like it. It does not sound like they have a huge amount of capital. I mean, again, the league, even from, you know, it's been about a year now since they threw their launch party back in New York City. You know, it was a great event. It also, there was not a lot of substance there, and there's always been this question of, who's investing money into this league? You know, is there a potential path to ownership for the teams? that sort of thing. So these questions have never really been answered. The books have never really been opened. There's not a lot of transparency on that financial side for the league. So we really have no idea what an impact of $200,000 would be on this league. But, you know, there have been a number of stories coming out over the past few months about the league. There is the chief operating officer, George Spears, got forced out. It was definitely messy. There's been a story about the league was unable to pay Bauer Hockey for equipment that they had basically given to the players. And so there's definitely sort of a recurring pattern here that, you know, it's not all smiles and rainbows inside that league office, especially on the financial side.
If we're looking at the league in itself, there's a couple of examples of the NWHL team, like I'll use the Canadiens from Montreal, which actually partnered with the Montreal Canadiens to get help in a couple of different ways, market-wise, partnership in, with money, branding, and everything. How is the league looking generally to do maybe the same thing league-wide to help maybe the burden and the cost of the whole managing of the league, which seems to be the case if you're looking at outside the problems with this potential lawsuit and other relationships that were in that management? Technically, the league seems to be lacking funds as well. So what is the pathway going forward?
No, I think that this was always started in the hopes that it would eventually – you know, prove itself to be this viable, thriving market for women's hockey fans, whether they be male or female, that sort of thing. So I think it was always sort of designed to be like, if we can do this on our own successfully for a while, eventually we're going to get that support, whether it's from NHL or from somewhere else. And, you know, there had always been mentions of conversations, like at that launch party, Danny Ryland, the commissioner, said, I've had conversations with Gary Bettman. Nothing ever really seemed to come of that. There was some NHL support during the year. Patrick Burke, who is in player safety and has been a very big proponent for women's hockey, came in to help with some of the player safety issues. But there has never really been beyond that, like a direct, like the NHL is really looking at this. You know, they NHL was able to get that women's hockey showcase at the Winter Classic this year, which was sort of a very thrown together event despite being in the works for quite some time behind the scenes, but bringing in the Montreal team from CWHL, the Boston Pride from NWHL, there's certainly interest from NHL in seeing how this market does, but right at the moment, the way that NWHL is looking operationally and financially, I would not, if I'm the NHL, I'm looking at that, I'm going, oh boy, all right, do I really want to wade into this right now?
You mentioned the kind of idea of putting the last minute, and it seems to be a recurring pattern that appears in different side of this league. Did this league launch a year too early? Should that league maybe have took some time to put the foundation in place solidly so things like what we're seeing right now doesn't happen?
You know, I'm coming from a women's soccer side, so I've seen, you know, I was an intern for the Boston Breakers back during WSA days, 2000, 2001. So I've seen each one of these leagues come and go. I've seen what has worked. NWSL, clearly year four. It's the first time we're hitting year four. The formation of that had a lot of support from U.S. Soccer, from CSA, from the Mexico Federation as well. Like, you know, you saw a lot of work going behind the scenes. I don't know if that was the case. It's not necessarily that it was rushed. I just don't think that, you know, and we see this a lot in women's sports, that you're trying to run lean in the front office for the league. So you're trying to do a lot with a few people, and even with the best of intentions, the execution is either lacking or they just don't have the tools to do it or the money to do it. So you're trying to do a lot with very little. So I think that has come into play. I do think that it was certainly a rushed, you know, it basically happened in the span of a summer, putting everything in place. So I think we saw it time and time again throughout the year, having they had problems getting facilities for the semifinals and the finals for the playoffs. And, you know, it's just that sort of logistical thing where bits of it don't look great. It doesn't necessarily impact the lives of the players a huge amount, but when you're looking at it, you can tell that there's definitely a next level for this league to hit.
Meg, from an outside perspective, someone who's interested in hockey, likes women's hockey, but doesn't maybe follow it day to day like you, like you do, you might look at the CWHL and the NWHL and wonder, why can't they work together to create a solution that is beneficial to the to North America, both Canada and the United States?
Right. And, you know, I think that it's certainly, I've heard a lot of players definitely on both sides expressing that they want to play with each other because they want to play with the best and against the best. So in terms of developing American hockey players and Canadian hockey players, like in the long run, it's probably best for everyone if these, you know, two very powerful nations within women's hockey are in the mix together. I do think that there's a lot of personalities behind the scenes. There's a lot of ongoing, you know, from a federation standpoint, does USA Hockey consider that in the best interest of its players? Do they want to keep them sort of segregated and, you know, training amongst themselves as to not give away secrets? I mean, I think we sort of saw this in the early days of NWSL, where you'd have the Canadian players come in and there was a little bit of, like, hesitation there. I don't think it's off the table, but I'm not entirely sure what that next step would have to be in order to get the two leagues really talking again. I mean, they work together on the Winter Classic. It's certainly not outside the realm of possibility, but just based on what I have seen right now, I think CWHL is kind of watching NWHL and going, all right, what's going on here? So I think they'd probably hesitate just as much as NHL to wade back in.
Fair enough. Let's not end on a negative. Can you tell us real briefly what some of the highlights of the first season of NWHL?
I mean, the play was great. I mean, you saw, you know, Boston Pride were always going to be the favorites, a number of USA athletes on that team. But there was definitely a spell where, I mean, they lost, I think, three games in a row. There was definitely a spell where they looked vulnerable. Connecticut Whales started very strong, undefeated for a very long time. And then you saw Buffalo Buttes finally clicking and come up. And, you know, they had never beat the Connecticut team and then took them to the playoffs, took them three games and upset them. And I think that's probably one of the best storylines of this season. You see a practice player like Telly Stedman, who, you know, had done her time in the USA hockey program and basically sort of lost that position with the national team, just coming up huge time and time again and balancing that coaching lifestyle with the playing and making the impact when she was able to make games. Like, there's a huge potential for this sport to grow. And it's really unfortunate that the league is in this position where it's calling into the question, because the product on the ice was spectacular. There was not, you know, there might have been a couple iffy games at the start, but by the end of the season, all teams were competitive. There were some great showcases of talent. Every team had players that could change a game. New York Riveters had the goaltender from Japan, Nana Fujimoto. Like, there were some great storylines, and these players definitely deserve a second season to continue that showcase.
And women's hockey needs effective club options so that the parity issue that this affects the sport can fix itself.
Right, and we're starting to see those internationals come in. And, you know, there weren't a huge amount in the league for this first year. We had a few Canadians come down. But, you know, if it becomes this real option, you could get players from Finland, from Czech Republic, from Russia. We had a couple of Russians in the league this year. Like, that's where you're going to get these players ice time to develop their skills and to improve the quality of international play.
All right, Meg, I do appreciate your time today. Quickly, before you go, tell the listeners about this Excel Sports, and give them your Twitter handle if you could.
Sure. So Excel Sports, women's only website. We're going to have a lot of, I'm going to make sure we have a lot of women's hockey, women's soccer, WNBA, all sorts of stuff, swimming, Olympic coverage. They're on Twitter at Excel Sports, E-X-C-E-L-L-E, Sports. I'm on Twitter at It's Meg Linehan, so I-T-S-M-E-G-L-I-N-E-H-A-N.
Thanks again for your time. I appreciate it on short notice.
All right. Thank you.
You are listening to SPN, the Sports Podcasting Network.
And welcome back to the Five Rings Podcast. Dwayne Willens with Kevin Laramie. Joining us on the line is Meg Linehan, She is soon to be the managing editor of Excel Sports. Meg is also an expert on women's hockey and women's soccer, for that matter. A good follow on Twitter. We'll get her Twitter address out at the end. Meg, how are you doing?
I'm pretty good today. How are you?
I'm well. We wanted to have you on to talk about the NWHL and what is currently happening within that. It just completed its first season, but rather than talk about, you know, the wonderful athletes on the ice, instead we're talking about battles in court. Can you just lay the land for us and tell us what's happening right now?
Sure. So right at the moment, there's actually no official lawsuit on the books yet. They were expecting it yesterday. It doesn't look like it got filed in time, so sounds like it might happen today. But basically what's happening is there's a founding investor, Mike Moran, who seems to have been involved since the founding days of the league, definitely had some sort of at least friendly relationship with the league's commissioner, Danny Ryland, and he's now looking for either his founding investment, personal loans. There's a little bit of unknown here as to what the official investment relationship is, but he invested about $200,000 into the league, has been trying, it sounds like, for many months to get that investment back. And so what's been happening over the last few days is there was a letter of demand from his legal representation to the league asking for an amount right around $184,000. Said that the league had offered him $100,000, was not acceptable on his terms, looking for $184,000. The deadline was this past Friday at 5 p.m. Eastern time. That deadline appears to have come and gone. So now we're waiting to see if the lawsuit is actually filed. It seems like an amount probably over $200,000. Excel Sports, we were able to obtain redacted documents that have direct evidence of investments, checks, Bank of America statements, that sort of thing. When I totaled those up, it was about $193,000, give or take, but I'm not sure all of those will be in the scope of that lawsuit.
All right, Meg, this sounds like if this were to be a successful action, and we don't know whether it would be or not, but if it were, that this would actually put this league in jeopardy. Is that a fair assumption?
It definitely sounds like it. It does not sound like they have a huge amount of capital. I mean, again, the league, even from, you know, it's been about a year now since they threw their launch party back in New York City. You know, it was a great event. It also, there was not a lot of substance there. And there's always been this question of who's investing money into this league? You know, is there a potential path to ownership for the teams? That sort of thing. So these questions have never really been answered. The books have never really been open. There's not a lot of transparency on that financial side for the league. So we really have no idea what an impact of $200,000 would be on this league. But, you know, there have been a number of stories coming out over the past few months about the league. There is the chief operating officer, George Spears, got forced out. It was definitely messy. There's been a story about the league was unable to pay Bauer Hockey for equipment that they had basically given to the players. And so there's definitely sort of a recurring pattern here that, there, you know, it's not all smiles and rainbows inside that league office, especially on the financial side.
If we're looking at the league in itself, there's a couple of examples of the NWHL team, like I'll use the Canadian in Montreal, which actually partnered with the Montreal Canadiens to get help in a couple of different ways, market-wise, partnership in with money, branding, and everything. How is the league looking generally to do maybe the same thing league-wide to help maybe the burden and the cost of the whole managing of the league, which seems to be the case if you're looking at outside the problems with this potential lawsuit and other relationships that were in that management? Technically, the league seems to be lacking funds as well. So what is the pathway going forward?
You know, I think that this was always started in the hopes that it would eventually, you know, prove itself to be this viable, thriving market for women's hockey fans, whether they be male or female, that sort of thing. So I think it was always sort of designed to be like, if we can do this on our own successfully for a while, eventually we're going to get that support, whether it's from NHL or from somewhere else. And, you know, there had always been mentions of conversations, like at that launch party, Danny Ryland, the commissioner, said, I've had conversations with Gary Bettman. Nothing ever really seemed to come of that. There was some NHL support during the year. Patrick Burke, who is in player safety and has been a very big proponent for women's hockey, came in to help with some of the player safety issues. But there has never really been beyond that, like a direct, like the NHL is really looking at this. You know, they NHL was able to get that women's hockey showcase at the Winter Classic this year, which was sort of a very thrown together event, despite being in the works for quite some time behind the scenes. But bringing in the Montreal team from CWHL, the Boston Pride from NWHL, there's certainly interest from NHL in seeing how this market does. But right at the moment, the way that NWHL is looking operationally and financially, I would not, if I'm the NHL, I'm looking at that, I'm going, oh boy, all right. Do I really want to wade into this right now?
You mentioned the kind of idea of putting the last minute, and it seems to be a recurring pattern that appears in different side of this league. Did this league launch a year too early? Should that league maybe have took some time to put the foundation in place solidly so things like what we're seeing right now doesn't happen?
You know, I'm coming from a women's soccer side, so I've seen, you know, I was an intern for the Boston Breakers back during WSA days, 2000, 2001. So I've seen each one of these leagues come and go. I've seen what has worked. NWSL, clearly year four. It's the first time we're hitting year four. The formation of that had a lot of support from U.S. Soccer, from CSA, from the Mexico Federation as well. Like, you know, you saw a lot of work going behind the scenes. I don't know if that was the case. It's not necessarily that it was rushed. I just don't think that, you know, and we see this a lot in women's sports, that you're trying to run lean in the front office for the league. So you're trying to do a lot with a few people, and even with the best of intentions, the execution is either lacking or they just don't have the tools to do it or the money to do it. So you're trying to do a lot with very little. So I think that has come into play. I do think that it was certainly a rushed, you know, it basically happened in the span of a summer, putting everything in place. So I think we saw it time and time again throughout the year, having they had problems getting facilities for the semifinals and the finals for the playoffs. And, you know, it's just that sort of logistical thing where the optics of it don't look great. It doesn't necessarily impact the lives of the players a huge amount, but when you're looking at it, you can tell that there's definitely a next level for this league to hit.
Meg, from an outside perspective, someone who's interested in hockey, likes women's hockey, but doesn't maybe follow it day to day like you, like you do, you might look at the CWHL and the NWHL and wonder, why can't they work together to create a solution that is beneficial to North American, both Canada and the United States?
Right. And, you know, I think that it's certainly, I've heard a lot of players definitely on both sides expressing that they want to play with each other because they want to play with the best and against the best. So in terms of developing American hockey players and Canadian hockey players, like in the long run, it's probably best for everyone if these, you know, two very powerful nations within women's hockey are in the mix together. I do think that there's a lot of personalities behind the scenes. There's a lot of ongoing, you know, from a federation standpoint, does USA Hockey consider that in the best interest of its players? Do they want to keep them sort of segregated and, you know, training amongst themselves as to not give away secrets? I mean, I think we sort of saw this in the early days of NWSL, where you'd have the Canadian players come in and there was a little bit of, like, hesitation there. I don't think it's off the table, but I'm not entirely sure what that next step would have to be in order to get the two leagues really talking again. I mean, they work together on the Winter Classic. It's certainly not outside the realm of possibility, but just based on what I have seen right now, I think CWHL is kind of watching NWHL and going, all right, what's going on here? So I think they'd probably hesitate just as much as NHL to wade back in.
Fair enough. Let's not end on a negative. Can you tell us real briefly what some of the highlights of the first season of NWHL?
I mean, the play was great. I mean, you saw, you know, Boston Pride were always going to be the favorites, a number of USA athletes on that team. But there was definitely a spell where, I mean, they lost, I think, three games in a row. There was definitely a spell where they looked vulnerable. Connecticut Whale started very strong, undefeated for a very long time. And then you saw Buffalo Butte finally clicking and come up. And, you know, they had never beat the Connecticut team and then took them to the playoffs, took them three games and upset them. And I think that's probably one of the best storylines of this season. You see a practice player like Telly Stedman, who you know, had done her time in the USA hockey program and basically sort of lost that position with the national team, just coming up huge time and time again and balancing that coaching lifestyle with the playing and making the impact when she was able to make games. Like, there's a huge potential for this sport to grow. And it's really unfortunate that the league is in this position where it's calling into the question, because the product on the ice was spectacular. There was not, you know, there might have been a couple iffy games at the start, but by the end of the season, all teams were competitive. There were some great showcases of talent. Every team had players that could change a game. New York Riveters had the goaltender from Japan, Nana Fujimoto. Like, there were some great storylines, and these players definitely deserve a second season to continue that showcase.
And women's hockey needs effective club options so that the parity issue that this affects the sport can fix itself.
Right, and we're starting to see those internationals come in, and you know, there weren't a huge amount in the league for this first year. We had a few Canadians come down, but you know, if it becomes this real option, you could get players from Finland, from Czech Republic, from Russia. We had a couple of Russians in the league this year. Like, that's where you're going to get these players ice time to develop their skills and to improve the quality of international play.
All right, Meg, I do appreciate your time today. Quickly, before you go, tell the listeners about this Excel Sports, and give them your Twitter handle if you could.
Sure. So Excel Sports, women's only website. I'm going to make sure we have a lot of women's hockey, women's soccer, WNBA, all sorts of stuff, swimming, Olympic coverage. They're on Twitter at Excel Sports, E-X-C-E-L-L-E, Sports. I'm on Twitter at It's Meg Linehan, so I-T-S-M-E-G-L-I-N-E-H-A-N.
Thanks again for your time. I appreciate it.
You are listening to SPN, the Sports Podcasting Network. Good day, good night, and welcome to the first ever live call-in show of SPN Radio. Kevin Larmay joining you live from the SPN Command Center.
My old man sings poetry for 50.
Lines are open, 929-477-3874. No boundaries on this show. You can talk about any sports-related or non-sports-related content in Open Lines After Dark. I am Kevin Larame, and you are listening to SPN Radio. Sports. What a great way to experience emotion and life in itself, you know? Just look at the last couple, let's just say the last week in the world of sports. It's been kind of crazy. And you have the whole Conor McGregor situation with the UFC. Unfortunately, sad news in the world of professional wrestling. Another passing of a legend. China this time. Champions League, Manchester City today. And Real Madrid, 0-0. Montreal Impact, lost 2-0 in the 4-1 Derby. 100 days to Rio. Leicester City. What a story. Leicester City, out of England. Out of Leicester, yeah. 3 points away from the Champions League. They are the Champions League. 3 points away from the Premier League glory. They beat Man United on Sunday. It's all over. What a great season of sports we're having. You know, it's a time of year where you have the NHL playoffs, you know. And, yeah, of course, if you're from Canada this time of year, usually it's excitement. It's great to be there and experience and watch the games on TV of the Canadian teams, and the whole country gathers behind one team. Well, this year there's no team. There's no team to gather around, and the ratings on TV have really felt the lack of Canadian content on television. So for now, the NHL ratings have been really taking a hit. So yeah, it's the greatest time of year for sports. If you're usually in the NHL playoffs with Canadian teams, or Montreal Canadiens, if you're from the same neck of the woods as I'm from, But, you know, right now we're looking at a state of things where you have NHL playoffs, NBA playoffs, the Raptors pulling out a victory at the end of the game. Crazy shot to win the third, the fifth game. They win now 3-2 in that series. They're winning that series so far. But, yeah, you have the NBA playoff, NHL playoff. F1 season is in the thick of things. The biggest season ever in the world of F1. 21 races this year. Crazy. 21 races. Can you imagine 21 races? It's really mind-blowing when you imagine that they're going to race almost every 2 weeks for the next 7-8 months. It almost feels like NASCAR. Well, yeah. Well, it's going to be very interesting. And even though Nico Rosberg is very in front in the whole championship, you never know what can happen. That's the beauty of a 21-week season, you know? You never know what can happen, 21 races in F1 this year. But, yeah, it's the greatest time of sports of the year. All the leagues of North American soccer have started. MLS is now going to be in week 7 starting tomorrow night. Montreal Impact, New York City FC. You can call in to talk about this game. And you have NASL as well in week 4 in the NASL. That's going to be very interesting. If you like the NASL, you can listen to the Sports Podcasting Network's one of the flagship shows, the network NASL Nightcap, hosted by Theo Gauthier. New show coming out Wednesday morning. It's in the editing process now, so very, very shortly you will be able to. We have a first call on the show live. First call. How you doing? Hello. What's your name and where are you calling from?
You know who this is.
Hello, Daniel. How you doing tonight?
Hello there, Kevin. Congratulations.
Thank you very much for joining me tonight on my first SPN radio show.
Why not? I mean, you know, you're the king of internet radio up in Canada, and especially in Quebec province and Montreal, so why not call in?
No, exactly. And it was we're not going to lie, it's our test show to prepare and get all the kinks worked out for the new upcoming Soccer Today show, which wants to basically take over not necessarily the mantle and not necessarily the amount of work that Jason Davis and Trevor Ayward in Soccer Morning, but the idea behind it is to open the lineups for soccer fans all across North America, Daniel. So that's the basis of this network.
Absolutely. And let me just say this. If we're going to talk a little soccer here, we're going to have to talk about refereeing, because it's just been absolutely shameful and dreadful what is going on with our referees in MLS, especially in the pro end of things. Because, you know, the funny thing is, it was Canadian on Canadian Sunday night at Red Bull Arena with Carl Ouimet of the Red Bulls, of course, from outside of Montreal, against Kyle Lahren, who is, you can definitely say, the future striker for the national team of Canada.
The present striker of the national team of Canada.
Yes, that's true too. But I'm saying, like, you know, if Canada's going to move forward in the world stage, I think Lahren is your man. You just have to hope you get some good midfield presence on the attacking end. I mean, I know Will Johnson will be doing the job, but still, you know, Lahren's going to be a big, big help now for the national team. But here's the funny thing, and while, yes, I'm not going to sugarcoat it, that was a red card. Ouimet should have been sent off. That is definitely a red card offense. Outside the box, so it wasn't a penalty, but still it's a red card. But here's the interesting thing. And the shame of it is that the assistant referee, and I still have the match on my DVR, Kyle Lahren was offside before he got the ball. So if you really think about it, two wrongs, sadly, pro does not get right. And that's a big concern, because, you know, obviously if the offside flag would have gone up, then the red card situation would, you know, was that a red card? You know, should he have been sent off? That doesn't get discussed. So if you really think about it, certain decisions that these referees are making are costing games, you know, fair discussion of what is going on in the field. And unfortunately, the discussion now is, well, look what the referee just did. He just ruined the match.
No, exactly. And if you're looking at the Red Bulls, they're a tough beginning of the season. I remember the Montreal Impact's home opener a few weeks ago, a month ago now. Jesse Marsh was talking how it was very difficult for the team to get goals. And what's wrong with the Red Bulls, Daniel, in 2016? Seems like, I don't know if it's the pressure of having success in 2015 this season, or maybe the rest of the league has caught up to the Red Bulls. So what is it with the Red Bulls in MLS this year?
Yeah, that's the second part, Kevin. People have figured out the Red Bulls, and even though the Red Bulls are not going to change what they're doing right now, the truth of the matter is this. The clubs in the league have figured them out. That's number one. And number two, injuries have also hit the Red Bulls pretty hard. I mean, we saw what happened against Houston, which would be the third match of the season, when Gonzalo Verón, of course, the former San Lorenzo man, when he's implemented into the lineup, he infuses the offense. So if you have him playing, obviously, at a, you know, at 100% fitness, he's going to dominate and help Bradley Wright Phillips get his goals as well. At the same time, he's going to score himself. So that's a big problem. Obviously, Miazga going to Chelsea, that's also a problem. And Damien Perenelle from France, obviously he's not back yet, and he was a big, big cog in the back line, especially as a center back. You know, he can definitely help out with Zubar. He helped out, obviously, with Miazga, and when Umet played a couple of games as a center back partner. So you're missing a big time center back in Damien Perenelle, as well as Gideon Ba, who is shown to be a solid center back. Unfortunately, his injury, of course, is not a good thing either. Even though Zubar is back, and it's nice to see a veteran being out there, still, Perenelle is the big glue in the back line. But still, everyone knows their job. Everyone knows what they have to do. The problem is it's just not giving up the counter and getting converted against them. So that is the two things. But once the back line gets better and once Perenelle comes back, I think everything will be fine. Actually, when you have Verón in the starting 11, it won't be a 4-2-3-1 anymore. It'll probably be like a 4-2-2-2. So, you know, we'll see what happens when Verón does come back, hopefully this coming Friday night against FC Dallas, and we'll see what happens.
You're listening to Open Lines After Dark. I'm Kevin Lamry. I am joined by Daniel Feierstein of Feierstein's Fire American Soccer Radio Show. Daniel, tomorrow night, NYCFC Montreal Impact in MLS. One of the first double week in MLS, always a great time in Major League Soccer, especially if you're playing fantasy. What can you tell us a little bit about NYCFC and their new coach, Patrick Vieira, and maybe how him and Pirlo don't see eye to eye?
Well, the thing is this. It's not so much that Villa and Vieira don't see eye to eye. I mean, Frank Lampard continues to be hurt. He just continues not being available for the starting 11 because of injury. Apparently, he keeps pulling muscles. I mean, he's going full out in training. He has to understand he can't do that anymore. And at the same time, Andrea Pirlo only basically spends half of the training sessions every week. So, you know, Pirlo is not doing well either. I mean, granted, he still has the magical touch of crosses and playing solid defense and stuff like that. But once again, Pirlo is just showing, I believe, while he has some good moments, he's got some bad moments as well. And right now, David Villa is the only good thing that's going on for New York City FC.
Other than that, it's the bottom 12 for the New York teams this year in the MLS.
Absolutely. And right now, because of the win on Sunday night against Orlando City for the Red Bulls, they are out of the basement. I mean, they're still below that red line for the playoffs, but still, they're out of the basement. So where does New York City FC go when they lose their match to Philadelphia? They go to the basement. So at this moment in time, while right now the Red Bulls, they still have to get out of their hole. They still have to dig out of their hole. New York City FC is back in a hole. And unfortunately, once again, unless something changes, unless Patrick Vieira gets certain players that he wants, and it has to be the right players. You can't go for the flashy. You can't go for the high profile.
But he's not going to sign Ronaldo, you know.
Oh, please. No, he's not coming here. He's going to go to David Beckham's Miami team.
Two things. I want to touch on David Beckham's Miami in a second. Have you made your way to the Yankee Stadium for an NYCFC City game? Yes, it's last year.
Last year, yes.
Okay. So you've experienced a game at the stadium and you've seen the pitch. Mm-hmm. Can you describe both? How is a game at Yankee Stadium? Because you would think that, yeah, the sideline and things would probably not be good, but the stadium itself is state of the art. And what's the experience like?
The experience is this. While it's fantastic, atmosphere is wonderful to hear. You love the atmosphere from the fans of the team. The truth of the matter is this. Whenever you see grass being laid on top of the infield dirt from the first base all the way to shortstop, it looks terrible because, once again, the grass is not taking hold on the infield dirt. Now, let me just say this. I am a New York Yankee fan. I am a big New York Yankees fan. I was born in the Bronx. I've taken the subway, the D train, the 4 train to Yankee Stadium from my old apartment. I love going to see my New York Yankees play. But unfortunately, I soured because it was being played in a baseball stadium where the sight lines and the field measurement is well off. And there's a reason why that the Red Bulls last year took advantage of New York City FC, because, you know, that they would have, you know, they won the coin toss. They wanted to be in the outfield grass for the second half. And that's where they scored all their goals. Luis Robles did a pretty good job of keeping the ball out of the net against New York City FC. Obviously, they scored first in that game early in the first half, but still, the game plan was, you know, hold them off. If you get scored on, it's okay. It's no big deal. But when you get to the second half, boom, Bradley Wright Phillips made it 1-1. Boom, Chris Duvall made it 2-1. And then, of course, Matt Miazga made it 3-1. And some fantastic saves by Robles last year. So all I can say is this. In New York City, it is the most hardest city in the world to try and get not just a sports arena or a sports stadium. It's tough to get a soccer stadium because there's just not enough land to build one inside the five boroughs. Now, if they do find one, and, you know, what would it mean? Where are they going to build it? I don't know.
You can build it on top of a building, you know? You take a building that's wide enough and you build the damn thing on top of it.
Maybe so, but still,
here's
though,
an idea, because that's the only way they'll find land.
Well, where are you going to find the land? I mean, obviously.
Exactly.
That's the point, you know. I mean, let's be honest with ourselves here. I mean, you know, you're up in Canada, of course. You know, you can build a hockey arena. It's not a big deal in Canada. You can build a hockey arena. You know, whether it's be for the kids, it's going to be for the neighborhood, it's going to be for the small town, for a minor league hockey team in the AHL, juniors, Quebec Major Junior Hockey League, and stuff like that. You can build a new arena, and it'll go through. Here, it's the only place to build a new stadium. For the Yankees at the time, they went across the street on 161st Street, and that's the only place they could build a new stadium, was to take over the park, and then when the old stadium was torn down, you just make a new public park for the community. You know, where Shea Stadium is in Queens, that got knocked down when they were building the new Citi Field, and then they knocked down Shea for basically reclaiming the parking lot. So that's it. Believe me, it would have been nice, you know, if you can find a way to build a soccer stadium in the five boroughs. And if it was able for the Metro Stars / New York Red Bulls, I would be traveling to New York City, no problem. It wouldn't be a big deal. But it's tough. I mean, you know, so many people have said, well, why don't you build it in this spot where there's a parking garage, which was across from the old stadium? Well, there's a problem because there's a ramp that is being used by Yankee fans when you're coming down the Major Deegan Expressway, and that's one of the main arteries of a highway in the Bronx that you can get to Yankee Stadium going southbound. And so, you know, that's where the parking garage is, and then you got to buy the land from a business, which, of course, they decided to, no, they don't want to sell their land. It was an old elevator factory building business. Now they're doing, like, solar paneling, because obviously that's the newest thing for them. And then you have to redesign the streets to at least accommodate to build a stadium. And it's tough. It's very tough.
Yeah. Last question before I talk to you about something else and
sure.
Before I let you go. You know, Beckham and the Miami situation. It's been so long, and it's been taking so long to find a stadium, to find investors, whatever. Now, allegedly, he sold or maybe has partnered up with some Dubai or maybe Qatar assets that would maybe take care of the team, and he would be maybe the spokesperson. Anyways, he still has a group, and they're looking at getting line and getting a team for 2018. But time's making it's getting short. It's getting really short on time if you want a team playing in 2018. We're almost in mid-2016. What's your thought on the whole Miami MLS situation? And now there's a team that actually has been built and they're playing in Miami now in ASL, Miami FC, coached by former Montreal Impact defender Alessandro Nesta. So what's your deal? What's your thought on the Miami deal with Beckham? And will we ever see a Miami MLS, a Beckham team?
You know, to be honest with you, I do see a Miami MLS team coming in. Obviously, there is some land that they purchased that's next to the baseball stadium where the Miami Marlins play on the site of the former Orange Bowl. It looks like it can handle a soccer stadium. We'll see what happens. It might be a little bit tighter than normal, but we'll see what happens. You know, Beckham has gotten this far and this dedicated to give up. I don't see any quit in David Beckham when it comes to building this stadium as well as getting ready for his Miami MLS side. You know, Miami FC in the NASL, congratulations to them, over 10,000 fans coming to see them play. Even though it was a draw in their first home match over at the FIU Stadium, you know what? That says that Miami is ready for American soccer, because I think you know as well as I do, a lot of expats from South America live in South Beach, live in Miami. Yeah. It doesn't matter if you're Brazilian, Colombian, Argentine, Ecuadorian, Peruvian, Venezuelan, Bolivian, you know, they will always support their club sides back home where they came from. But it's great to see Miami fans at least going to that FIU stadium to watch Miami FC. What will David Beckham do when this finally comes to fruition? I think regardless, if you bring in a well-named player, and I think everyone's already said this, like you said, will Cristiano Ronaldo come to MLS? I think he will, but I think he's waiting patiently to come to MLS and go to Miami. I don't think he's going to go anywhere else. I don't think he wants to go to a city where it's cold in North America. I don't think he's coming to Chicago. I don't think he's going to New York. I think he's going to go to Miami, and he's going to wait patiently for Beckham.
That would make sense. All right, to move on to other sports, because we pride ourselves here on Open Lines After Dark. I am Kevin Arme, and I am joined by Daniel Ferristein of Talking About Every Sports. All sports are fair game. What other sport is catching your attention lately in your New York, New Jersey, Grand Metropolitan area of New York lately,
Daniel? Well, you know, obviously the New York Rangers got eliminated by the Pittsburgh Penguins in five games in the first round. And
Dan Boyle losing his mind today?
Yes, he did, because Larry Brooks, the New York Post hockey writer, has angered him very badly. So,
what's the post about? Can you tell us what's the post about? Because I only seen Dan Boyle losing his mind.
Simple. Basically, Larry Brooks and another hockey writer at the New York Post have basically been writing negative articles on Dan Boyle. Now, are they well-deserved? Maybe so, maybe not. But the truth of the matter is that Dan Boyle does get along with the New York hockey media, except for Mr. Larry Brooks. And, of course, you might have remembered a nice little tiff with John Tortorella when he was the head coach of the Tampa Bay Lightning, having an argument with Larry Brooks. Yep, with Brooksy, exactly. you know, Larry Brooks... you know, whether it's intentional or whether it's just trying to get, you know, headlines in New York City, the truth is the man knows how to tweak certain people when they are either doing well or not doing well. And look, let me say this about Dan Boyle. You know, he's a fantastic person. He's a good man. Unfortunately, the contract the Rangers gave him, I felt it was not a good contract.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I knew that you're getting great experience from him, but if you're going to bring a man like Dan Boyle with his experience, he's got to defend better. He's got to be better on the power play, because that's what he's always been. Bomber on at the point, supposed to be leading a power play, and unfortunately, you know, he just couldn't cut it anymore. And hopefully he will retire, you know, this summer, because the man's had a great career in the National Hockey League. But unfortunately for me, as a Ranger, while I think he had a decent first year, the next one or two were just terrible. And, you know, even I said they got to trade him. Even I said they got to trade him. I don't care what he does here or does there. I didn't think Dan Boyle had enough left in the tank to perform the way he should have. And we all know you're coming to the end of the road. And we all know as a professional athletes, you know, it's tough for them to go out, you know, the way that they want to go out sometimes. You know that. You've seen great players playing for the Montreal Canadiens that have, you know, I mean, they, you know, they struggle with the thought of retirement because they think they can go another year or two, and then all of a sudden everyone else is beating them, and they're, you know, either beating old goalies or beating old defensemen and scoring, or, you know, the forwards just can't put the puck in the net as consistent as they used to.
No, absolutely, Daniel. Daniel Fairstein, host of the American Soccer Show on the Fairstein Fire on Blog Talk Radio right here. Daniel,
That's
thank
right.
you very much for joining me on my first ever live radio show, Dan.
Congratulations, Kevin. You know, it's a knack when you're doing these live streaming shows, obviously. And, you know, once you get through the first one, it's old hat, my friend. You'll be able to do it. Everything will be fine. Don't show any nerves. Don't let the nerves hit your voice. I know you're going to do perfect for this one. So congratulations on that, and I'll talk to you next time.
Thank you, Daniel. Have a good night.
Thank you.
And we'll take
you
a
too.
Small
Bye-bye.
Little break, and we'll be right back after this. You are listening to the Sports Podcasting Network. You're a big soccer fan? ESPN is the place to be. USL Radio, NASL Nightcap, Two Solitude Soccer Podcasts, Off the Woodworks, Ours is the Fury, 2S Extra, the rest of the story. ESPN is the place to be. And we had our first caller. That's done. That's dusted. Thank you, Daniel. You know, one of the things that caught my attention in the world of sports over the last few, well, days and week is the Conor McGregor situation. The tweet that he retires and the whole background story that not everybody knows. And is it just about the fact that he doesn't want to do promotion, didn't want to do that trip to Vegas and shoot that commercial and go to that promotion and go do that press conference in New York after? Is it really about that? Is it about something else? Is it about maybe something that he's been wanting to ask the UFC for the last three, four fights, and they've said no. Maybe next time. Maybe that was it. Maybe he wants to do co-promotion, maybe. Maybe that's the one thing he's asking for, and they're not going to give it to him. That's possible, you know. It's hard to imagine that there's not something else behind it than just, oh, I didn't want to do a promotion, didn't want to break camp because I want to focus on Nate Diaz that much, and maybe ran the chance of leaving $8-9 million on the table by not fighting at UFC 200. And then the subsequent tweet saying, I got the game slayed, my money made, and I can just leave type of tweet. And then tweeting 36 hours ago, I'm back on UFC 200. Yeah, I'm back. Thanks to Reza Fertitta. Thanks to Dana White for everything. And the UFC saying, no, he's not back on UFC 200. So the whole jibber-jabber ball in one camp and the other, it seems like it's a negotiation in the media, in covert words. And nobody's actually saying the truth, but everybody's saying the same type of story, so they don't look foolish with it. So, I don't know. I does feel and smell fishy to me. It does. I do think that there's another story behind it. I do feel that maybe the hypothetical, look, I want to co-promote. I want to have the chance to promote my fights myself. That could be the case. That could be possible. I don't know. That could be the case. It would make sense in a way, too, because that's what he's asking, is to look, I want to maybe co-promote. He asked for co-promotion, and that's the one instant where the UFC doesn't want to make a precedent. What if? What if the UFC actually gives him co-promotion? Then they have to give it to every big star that gets a certain threshold of fans? That they split like 50% of the revenue? Or what are they going to do? Like the UFC, it's a monopoly in a way that it's like the NFL and the NHL or those type of leagues. And not like boxing where the roster, it's underneath the same umbrella. There's a couple of other umbrellas, Bellator, World Series of Fighting, One Fighting, that are very small in scale. Bellator would be the biggest, still smaller in scale if you're looking at the revenue generated by the company compared to what the UFC can do. If you're looking at ratings-wise, Bellator had some arguments over the last few weeks with weird and freak show fights on TV, but that's another story for another day. But if you're looking at a UFC, revenue generation is the biggest of all mixed martial arts companies in the world. And for the UFC to give co-promotion to a fighter like Conor McGregor and give him a precedent and set a precedent that now everybody has to ask for it, or everybody's going to ask for it, and are they going to give it to people? No, they're not, because, well, it's a very different ball game. Give somebody a cut of a pay-per-view to give somebody co-promotion rights. It means that the books are open to him. It means that a lot of things that the UFC don't necessarily want to divulge will have to be divulged if there's a co-promotion. And I think that's one of the biggest reasons, one of the biggest factors that the UFC is never or not in our foreseeable future will not do the actual co-promotion with any fighter, Conor McGregor first or any other fighter, because of the reason that if they do, I do believe that technically they would have to share all the books. And that's one thing that UFC does not and does really not, doesn't want to do. You are listening to Open Lines After Dark. I am Kevin Laramie. You can give us a call right now, 929-477-3874. Hashtag SBN Radio. SBN Radio, the place where you will get live shows like this one. Call-in capability, guests, the home of Soccer Today, a show that will be starting in the next few couple of days. The schedule will be out, and the first shows will be made. We'll be having this right here on the Sports Podcasting Network / radio, SBN Radio, powered by the Sports Podcasting Network. You can visit sportspodcastingnetwork.com to get all your favorite sports radio shows on demand. iTunes, everywhere you like, you can get SBN as well, and SBN Radio. Again, this is Open Lines After Dark, and I am Kevin Laramie. Music on the Sports Podcasting Network is courtesy of St. Clair. Get their EP Moving on stclair.bandcamp.com. So is it all about Conor? Is it all about money? That's interesting. John Jones was fighting in the weekend against Ovince St. Preux in place of Daniel Cormier getting injured. Daniel Cormier is about to get some results from the doctors next week, next Monday if I'm not mistaken, and then he'll be able to evaluate when and where he'll be able to start training and can fight in concord. Maybe UFC 200, that would make sense. They need desperately a big fight to headline that show. That's not looking too good right now. So Conor McGregor not fighting on this card gives an opportunity that John Jones, even though he had a tough fight against Ovince St. Preux, is not able to put Ovince away. And Ovince went the distance, even though he got his arm broken by John Jones. John Breaking Bones Jones, I guess, now. But yeah, John Jones is now the interim, I guess, light heavyweight champion of the UFC. What does that tell you? One story in the world of sports in general is Leicester City, the Foxes. You know, we talk about crazy Cinderella stories that are like everybody falls in love with March Madness because of the Cinderella story of the first couple rounds. But never does a 16 seed team go on to win the freaking March Madness tournament. And that's the best analogy I can do to describe Leicester City right now. What the Foxes are going to achieve maybe as early as this Sunday by beating Manchester City. 3 points. 3 points no matter what else, no matter what the other team does, no matter what Tottenham does. 3 points is what they need. Tottenham, unfortunately, Monday, with a draw against West Bromwich Albion that saw them lose ground in the title race against the Foxes. And, you know, if you want to generally, like, quickly, me to give an overview of what the Foxes' season has been for Leicester this year, you know, the type of season it is, it's you start your first week, you get a victory, you get two, you get three, you know. You get results, and you're up at the table at the beginning. Everybody's like, yeah, it's a bottom team. They're lucky. They had an easy schedule, or they got an easy break here and there. Got a favorable result against a tougher team. It's lucky. It actually writes itself in the season. They're not going to stay there all season. And they just kept on racking points and kept on believing. The team coached by Claudio Ranieri, the old Italian, who has belief, and has always believed in his team, to be fair, and always been pragmatic, always one game at a time, one game at a time. And up until this week, he was still not freaking out. This week, it was starting to freak out. I said, dude, boys, we're in the freaking Champions League. Yeah, it's beautiful. Life is great. Yeah, and that was great to see Claudio Ranieri actually start to embrace and to let the emotion take the better of him and let the belief become reality and let the fact be faced that, look, they're going to win the Premier League. And it's starting to become reality. So all along the season long, all across those 34 weeks, 38, 34, I can't remember. I think it's 38 to be fair. 19 teams, 38. So every game, every chance they had, they got the points, they created a gap, they stayed on top of the Premier League, and down the stretch, it wasn't easy. Vardy suspension, red card, it was suspended, missed a game. They still won because of Mahrez, the player of the year, the player footballer of the year by PFA. In England, the first American, first African to do that in a long time in England. First ever in England to do that, actually. Let me rephrase that. The first player of the year by the Player Football Association. So that's the best player in England, named by the Association of Footballers. Mahrez from Leicester City. First African to win this honor in England. So that tells you the type of season the Leicester City has. And, you know, a lot of people talk about the beauty of the FA Cup or the beauty of the Premier League. Well, this is the best case scenario. This is the best possible, literally the best possible Cinderella story that we're going to be able to tell our children, tell our friends, to tell that story to a non-soccer fan, to make them believe and to make them see the look, it is possible. Cinderella stories are still possible in sports in 2016, in this world that is very convoluted and complicated with money and corruption everywhere. You still can have beautiful stories like Leicester City. And that's the beauty of the Foxes in 2016 and 2015, 2016. That's the beauty of their run. And there will be movies made about this season. There will be books written about this season, about every game, chapters about every game. Every game in itself can become a chapter of that story of the win by Leicester City. Again, I remind you, they only need 3 points to cement their Premier League win for this year in glory, Leicester City. Started from the bottom, now they're there. What a great story again for sports. It's hard to just want more than that. And you will be able to say in 5-10 years down the road, look, I was present, I was alive, I saw that story. And when you're going to go to the theater or on Netflix in 2 years down the road, when the documentary or the movie is ready, and you will see the story about Leicester City, you will be able to think about how great it was to see those Foxes play live and Vardy score that amount of goals and get that golden boot maybe and be able to put his name not only in the history of Leicester City, but get the ticket to get the kit of England and to get some caps for England, which was never in his mind. It was never a dream. We're talking about a boy that 4 years ago was playing in the Blue Conference, the fourth division, making 300 euros a week. And he climbed every echelon of the world of English soccer up until Leicester City with the belief of himself, with the belief of a team in a system, in a way to play for the club. And we're seeing this year getting results. I think it's a blueprint for every coach out there that it's possible. You don't need the hundred millions of dollars of Chelsea, Manchester City, or Man United. What you believe, what you need is belief. What you need is a system that you believe in. What you need is a system that you can adapt, that you can mold, that you can move forward, that you can help adapt towards your opponent to get results, to get points, to get that goal when it's needed in extra time, in the 92nd minute, when you need a point to get that gap on top of the Premier League, and you do it. That's the beauty of the Foxes. That's the beauty of the Premier League. That's the beauty of this season. When all hope of modern football is all lost, it's all dead because of the Chelsea's Abramovich, because of the Arabs of Manchester, Arabs Emirates, that's what I meant, Fly Emirates of Qatar or Qataris of Manchester City, and we have Manchester United with their millions of dollars they rack up because they're one of the most popular teams in the world, and the Madrid and Barca's of this world with Ronaldo's and Messi's. You know, when you think that modern football is dead with stories that don't tickle your fancy, that don't attract and don't spark the imagination by being beautiful and being the underdog, well, guess what? We were all wrong. It does exist. It still exists. And it will continue to exist. So for all cynics out there, me included, that talked about modern football is dead, it's not. We just have to know where to look. And sometimes our expectations are put at wrong places, and we do become cynical, and we do think that it's going to be all the same, and this team is going to dominate and win the whole championship. Sometimes we have to open our mind to the possibility of Leicester City being real. And right now, this year, Leicester City is real. Leicester City is on its way to win the Premier League. Who would have thought? Who would have thought? Speaking of soccer and Premier League, today, it was, well, yesterday now in England, it was announced that the judgment or the verdict was out in the justice for the 96, the Hillsborough disaster case, where today was made truth, but we knew it was truth all along that the 96 were killed. They didn't die of their own accord or because of their own fault or their own carelessness. No. They were killed. They were put like cattle and treated accordingly. And the police actually apologized. The police acknowledged guilt. And they were killed. And justice for the 96. So for the Liverpool supporters today, it's a big day. For the family, it's a very big day today as well, because they'll never walk alone. They're not walking alone. They haven't been forgotten. And justice, almost 30 years too late, yes. But justice has been at least acknowledged, and it's on its way. And maybe closure is going to be maybe easier now that that has been acknowledged. So justice for the 96. Very, very sad story. If you don't know the story, it's Hillsborough, a match against Sheffield Wednesday or Sheffield United. I can't remember by the life of me. It's been a long time. But yes, it's Liverpool fans, supporters, 96 of them died when the stadium collapsed. And they were it's a stand that collapsed. And they were pushed against the fans for people to get out. And 96 people died in the panic that ensued. So because there were gates that were locked, so they wouldn't get out. So that was very tragic. It is a very tragic incident. And it's something that, again, it was mentioned by Dwayne on the Five Rings podcast a couple of weeks ago. It was re-mentioned today as well on the show that we had Meg Linehan today. You know, nobody deserves to come back from a sporting event dead. No matter the circumstances, no matter the class, the poverty classes, if you're rich, poor, in the middle class, you're either the best stadium in the world or in a third world stadium, doesn't matter. Nobody deserves to return dead
from watching a sport that they love. Nobody at all. And that's a shame. That's a shame that it happens. It's a shame that it did happen. But you know what? At least maybe since then there was some steps taken to make sure that this doesn't happen again. But like I've seen three weeks ago now on social media by Colin Udo, which is a sports reporter, football reporter from Nigeria. It was a Nigerian friendly international break in Nigeria in a stadium that could maybe host 20,000 fans. There was about 50. I mean, maybe exaggerating, but there was at least 40. And there was people hanging from rafters, hanging from towers that were shaking and moving. And it's very lucky. Everybody's very lucky that no tragedy happened in that game. But it could have been there. And people need to do something about it. You know, those type of tragedies. And don't leave at least a risk to it to happen. So, again, I just go on calling you those timeline. Maybe 3 weeks ago now, it's going to be hard to find. But you'll see the pictures and the evidence of those type of offenses. It's basically, look, security guard needs to stop people. When the stadium is full, the stadium is full. Don't allow 5,000 more people. Don't sell tickets more to allow you to make more of a buck, more money, more profit, to put people in the stand that they cannot be on it and the stand is going to collapse and people are going to die. No, that buck is not worth that much. And a life is worth a lot more than that couple of dollars you're going to make if to put more people in the stadium that is supposed to be there. Last tidbit of news that I want to talk about on Open Lines After Dark here. I am Kevin Larmy. Once again, you are listening to SPN Radio. You can give me a call at 929-477-3874 to talk any sports. You can follow me on Twitter at Kev Larame or follow the Sports Podcasting Network at SportsPodNet. Again, I invite you to visit castingnetwork.com where you can find not only archived edition of Open Line After Dark, all the shows that we will be producing here on SPN Radio, all the shows that the Sports Podcasting Network does produce are on SportsPodcastingNetwork.com. Our goal, our mission is to bring high quality, on-demand, and live sports radio where you are, to bring it to you. You can listen to it wherever, whenever you are. And that's our mission. So you can visit us on sportspodcastingnetwork.com. But the last little tidbit of information and news I want to talk to you about today, it's a pro wrestling topic. So if you are not a fan of the squared, of the art of the squared circle, of grappling arts, if you prefer. Unfortunately, last week, and now almost 6 days ago, China, Joni Lauer of her real name, who used to wrestle for the WWE, WWF back then, as China Valley of Triple H to start with, then in the Generation X with Triple H and Shawn Michaels and Rick Rude beginning, and eventually to another program, and with a very popular program with Eddie Guerrero. Well, unfortunately, she passed away. The toxicology report or not in yet, and neither as the coroner report, but all indications as we're speaking right now leads to maybe a overdose. We're speculating here, but all signs point to this as we are talking. She has been found in her apartment 24 hours probably after her actual death. She was not answering her phone, and it's a friend that was actually doing a safety check, came up to check up on her, that found the body. She was in a bad state of mind over the last few weeks. Friends that have talking to her, like Mick Foley, which you can listen to on the PW Torch podcast, where Mick Foley and Jim Ross as well was talking to her recently. Both of them were able to gather that she was not in a good state of mind recently. She was dealing with bad situation. She had bad experiences since she left the WWE. So over the last decade, she really had a tough life. If you're looking at consumption, talking about substance consumption, talking about substance overdose, she was found at a VPN award, or AVN award, I believe, AVNA. It's a porn star award in Vegas. She was found passed out a few years ago. I think it was 2012, I believe. So she was found passed out in the pool, unfortunately. So, you know, it's a type of news that was not necessarily surprising. But it's just sad that it's another wrestling death. It's another pro wrestler that dies in a young age. She was 4 years old. And she does leave a big legacy. She did achieve great things in the squared circle. She became a great star nationally, internationally, for the World Wrestling Federation back in the 97-98 era, 97 when she debuted as Triple H's valet. She helped Triple H become over. Yes, she did. She was one of the main reason why he became unique, because of her look, of her appeal, and of her gathering of attention for Triple H, gathering of heat. And she was really good for that. And she became a babyface later on when the whole Degeneration X, and eventually she had other plastic surgeries. We're not going to lie. She had some breast implant surgery as well as some face reconstruction surgery to appeal physical, muscular facial shape and to change it to make her more in a womanly sex appeal type of way. That's how and why she, the reason behind those moves is to get the Playboy cover, which she did, which did propel her to another big stardom. It's a long time ago. It's a different era, but back in the late 90s, if you didn't know, and if you're too young to know about this, in the late 90s, if you become a Playboy model, if you just pose once for Playboy, it would elevate your stardom to a level that's hard to achieve another way for a woman back then. Unfortunately, it's a good thing that we moved on to a very much different way to look at how we perceived women in society. But back then, it was one of the goals was to get that Playboy cover. And it's a good thing it changed. But back then, especially in the WWE, once you got that Playboy cover, they would push you all the way for it. If you're looking at Sable, Tori Wilson, Thierry Runnels, Stacy Keibler, see, there's a pattern. And she was one of the first ones. We'll do that to Sable. So that's very interesting. But unfortunately, she passed away. She was a trailblazer. She was one of the first. Well, she was Intercontinental Champion. She beat men. And she was a women's champion as well for WWE. She was before the Divas era. She was a trailblazer in a way. She did show that women can look different than just a skirt and fragile in a wrestling world as a valet. You can be an intimidating physical ninth wonder of the world as a valet to help put over a star. It is possible. And we've seen this with China. So China, hopefully you were able to put things in place and finally get peace. That's probably the best we can hope for you. But you were a great champion in WWE. You were a trailblazer. You were a pioneer. And that's the message that we need to be praised for. You need to be praised for. That's the message that needs to be carried in the future. And I wouldn't be surprised if there's a WWE Hall of Fame calling next year. There's many reasons why they had trouble doing this while she was alive. Many different reasons. Because they don't want their reputation. And they don't want to the name association to be with a person that is maybe not in the best place where she can do things that would embarrass or put the situation where it put in an embarrassing situation WWE, which we've seen with Tamina and Sitch over the very near recent future. So that's one of the blueprints they don't want to recreate. And that was one of the reasons why she was not approached, not thought of in recent years for the Hall of Fame. Unfortunately, with her passing, those are the type of things that now comes back on the table is, look, now they can actually feel safe in a way to honor her because, well, she cannot do anything else now, not more at least, to embarrass the company. And it's sad to say, but her passing has probably opened the door on her being in the WWE Hall of Fame. So that's going to be one thing that's important to take a look in next year, almost 12 months from now. This brings us to the close of the first Open Line After Dark. I am Kevin Laramie. Hope you like this edition. A few kinks and bugs here and there. We're getting everything figured out here on SP Radio live call-in show. Again, write this in your phone. Put this in your phone for next time we have a live show. 929-477-3874. Call-in show. 929-477-3874 to talk sports. I am Kevin Laramie. You can visit our website, sportspodcastingnetwork.com. You can send us an email, sportspodcastingnetwork@gmail.com, SPN Radio. I am Kevin Armay, and until next time, have a great sports.
SPN, the Sports Podcasting Network. Visit us, sportspodcastingnetwork.com.
You were listening to SPN, the Sports Podcasting Network. Visit us, sportspodcastingnetwork.com.